ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At the end of World War II, thousands of Australian prisoners of war who'd survived the horrors of the Burma Thai Railway in Borneo and Japan and Ambon and Java and other labour camps were told by well-meaning officials to forget about the war and get on with their lives. How could they ever forget? Suffering from what is now known as post-traumatic stress disorder, they tried to lead normal lives, some successfully, but gee, a lot of them did not. And apart from the RSL lounges and the pubs, there was no counselling to help them deal with their mood swings. They often turned to alcoholism and fits of depression. Factors that also impacted greatly, of course, on their families, who had no concept of what their men had been through during their 3.5 years of captivity. Indeed, they mostly didn't talk about it either. Their children were perhaps most harshly affected. They were unable to understand what the war was about, let alone what it had done to their fathers and why they were often remote and angry and often very brutal. One such child was Di Elliott. She was born 3 years after her father, Fred Howe, returned from the Burma Thai Railway. For all of her childhood, she thought all fathers were cranky old buggers, as she put it, and she suffered greatly from his behaviours, which did include sexual abuse. After Fred died in the 1970s, Di found out much more about his war, and as it turned out, it was, pretty much as she put it, the worst war possible. Not that she was offering that as an excuse, but she started a memoir and then was struck down with herself with terminal brain cancer. So she asked her friend and research colleague, Lynette Silver. Now, many of you would know Lynette, of course, author of a number of books on World War II, to promise her something to finish Dad's story. It was a deathbed promise and one that Lynette has fulfilled with the publication of the ambiguously titled At War With My Father. Lynette is famed, as I say, for her own research into Allied prisoners of war and particularly the fate of those on Sandakan in Borneo, is with us this evening. Lynette, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
How did you come in contact with Di and therefore find out about Fred?
Back in 1998, Di Elliott heard me speaking on the radio on the ABC, So you're partially to blame,
and
that there was going to be a launch of my book on Sandakan. Mm. And after listening to me talking, she said, I've got to meet this woman. So she actually gate-crashed the book launch, and that's how I met her.
Oh, really?
And the next day we met up at a function and we clicked, and I'd never... In all the years I'd been researching, I hadn't come across anybody who actually knew what I was talking about.
Mm.
And now I had somebody who did. And she became my soulmate, my very best friend. And we could have conversations that went on for half an hour and no one else knew what we were talking about.
Wow. Okay. Who was Fred Howe?
Well, Fred Howe was Di's father. He was a sergeant, but he was quite a senior linesman with what was the PMG in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in the little country town of Boorowa,
mm-hmm.
New South Wales, very pretty spot out near Cootamundra that way, and had four children and was quite mature when he decided to enlist in the Second World War. And off he went to have what Di and I agree was the worst war possible for anybody who had been in battle and also as a prisoner of war.
Mm. Describe what had happened to him. We know some of the horrors of the Burma Thai Railway. This was only part of it for him, wasn't it?
Yes.
Tell us a bit about what happened to
him. Well, he enlisted in the 2nd 19th Battalion, which mm-hmm. was largely composed of people from the country, and went off very early in February of 1941 with the first group that went across to Malaya, thinking they were just going to garrison the place until Indian troops could take over and then they would chuff off to the Middle East.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that didn't happen. And at the end of the year, the Japanese attacked and Fred found himself in battle. Now, his battalion, along with another, were sent to hold back what was supposed to be 200 Japanese advancing down the west coast of Malaya.
Mm-hmm.
In actual fact, there were 10,000 crack Imperial Guardsmen.
Mm.
And these two battalions had their fight of their life for survival in what was probably the most horrific and courageous fighting retreat, I believe, of the Second World War, where these beleaguered men, under constantly being encircled by the Japanese and under constant bombardment from the air because all our aircraft had been shot up, we didn't have anybody.
The Japanese
had brought in tanks, which the British had always said you couldn't possibly use in Malaya. Well, you could.
Mm.
And they fought a fighting retreat to get back to a little village called Parrot Sulong. where the British were holding the bridge, the only exit. And when they got there, the British had gone, abandoned the bridge, and the Japanese were there, and the Australians were now trapped. And they fought hand to hand for about a day and a half, and eventually it was every man for himself. Mm. And we had to leave, unfortunately, 110 of our wounded behind at the bridge with a flag, Red Cross flag, and a surrender flag, in the hope that they would be looked after. And, of course, they weren't. They were all murdered.
They were all murdered,
Fred got out, fought in that battle. The battalion was reduced so badly, they took on 650 reinforcements. That's how many men they'd lost. So he was one of the few to get out of that encirclement alive and lived to tell the tale, to go on to Singapore Island, where he came under attack again when the Japanese attacked his battalion. Again, it was ripped apart, and he was one of the few to get out. And finally, he was put into a scratch battalion, which was ambushed in the dark, and about a dozen or so got out of that alive. So his battle experience was absolutely horrendous.
Already at this stage.
And then, of course, they went into captivity.
Of course, and that's right, the fall of Singapore, he's taken into captivity, and he's packed off to the Burma Thai Railway.
Yes, and very early. He went with what they call A-Force, which was in May of 1942, and they started at the Burma end, which was very difficult because the lines of supply were difficult. It was rainy season, and it was terrible, appalling. And at the end, when eventually the line was finished at the end of 1943, most people went back to Singapore, where it was much better, or were sent to Japan, where sometimes it wasn't. But he wasn't. He was one of the people kept behind to still work on the line. And then, as the Japanese realised that invasion from the West was going to be inevitable through Burma, they sent these prisoners of war up to build defences and to build tunnels for the Japanese. So he was there until after the war ended. So he didn't have any relief away from the railway until he got back, and miraculously
he survived. He was only days away from being executed at the end of the war, because the Japanese, that's what they did at the end. They killed everyone.
Yes. Well, on the 27th of August, he was told by Japanese guards that they'd just been released, that they were to be killed. And that was interesting, because on the 27th of August, the Japanese killed everybody still alive over in Borneo. So it must have been a blanket order that went out across their empire, that everybody was to be destroyed. And yes, it was his survival as a soldier was amazing, but his survival up on the prison, on the railway, was equally amazing.
You're the narrator in this story, although it's in a way Di's story, isn't it?
Yes, I'm the narrator. I encouraged Di to write down her thoughts about this, because it was a journey that she undertook 20 years after her father died. She decided to see what he'd done in the war.
And what did she want to do here? Did she want to understand why he behaved so badly?
Yes, she wanted to understand him and what had happened. And he never spoke about it. He was just, he'd go in these moods and he'd take himself off, or he'd lock himself in his room, or he'd get drunk. And he got quite bad fits of depression. And she had a photograph of a man with laughing eyes who was loved by everybody before the war. And the man that came back was not the same man. So she didn't know the father that her brothers and sisters knew. She only knew this man who'd fathered her.
This violent alcoholic.
And was, as she said, a crunky old bugger.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'd be the situation where she would be worried about bringing anybody home from school for fear of what sort of mood he might be in. So life was difficult as a child. She didn't realise that her life was different from anybody else's. She just thought that's how everybody was. So as she started to find out about this, she started to understand a bit about the trauma he'd been through. And by the time she had finished the end of her story, which took quite a long time to get there, she amazingly forgave him.
Did she really?
Absolutely. And you read the prologue of this book, and she says she hopes in time she'll be able to forgive him. And you think, she's not going to forgive him.
No.
Not in a million years. And then you get to the end and you realise what she does. So it's a story that unfolds of reconciliation.
Because he abused her and he sexually groomed her.
Yes, when she was only about five. It didn't last for very long, but it had a profound impact on her.
As it does.
She's only 5 or 6 years old. She's a little girl.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was a big thing to get over as well. But, you realise how Fred was heroic. I mean, you realise what he went through, and you wonder how anybody came home sane after it.
I entirely agree with you. You wonder how anybody came. I mean, you don't know how people behave. And you and Di went on a physical journey, didn't you, through Malaya to walk in Fred's footsteps?
Yes.
She wanted to actually go where he had been.
Well, after she'd done the research work, and I knew a lot about this anyway.
Of course you did.
So it was good that we were pals. But the story has three strands. There's Di in the footsteps and her thoughts. There's Fred, who amazingly, he was very well-educated. He left 27 separate accounts, first-hand accounts, of himself in battle.
Right, written by him.
Yes. Okay. And as a POW, which she didn't even know about till she started on this journey, and she found out that he had this diary. So there's 27 separate accounts. So he comes into the story, but I'm the narrator putting everything in the context. So the bulk of the story is written by me, where it has Di coming in and also has Fred's story slotted into my narration. So we went on this journey up to Malaya, and we went to all the places he'd been. Which, I mean, when we do the research and then you go to the place, it's like watching a movie unravel in front of your eyes. You actually can visualise what happened.
Yeah.
We went down to Parrot Sulong. The buildings that the prisoners were put into at the end are still standing. The bridge is still over there, even though there's a little village there now. You can walk around, you can actually see where everything happened. So she got a better understanding then of the fighting retreat and what he must have been through. And finally she went up to the Burma Thai Railway. And, of course, Fred was there right up to the Burma border, so it was quite a long journey. And she followed the traces of the railway and saw the cuttings and, you know, stood in the spots where he'd been, and it had an enormous effect on her for understanding him not only as her father but as a soldier and then as a prisoner of war.
I'm speaking with historian Lynette Ramsey-Silver about her book, At War With My Father, which is based on the memoirs of Fred Howe and Diane Elias. What's left of the Burma Railway these days anyway?
Oh, there's quite a lot up there. Yeah, you can follow quite well. I mean, you can go to Hellfire Pass.
You can still go to Hellfire Pass.
Oh, yes. And you find the traces right along. You know, it's there. If you go deep into the jungle, you can find the old embankments and all that sort of thing. It's very interesting. I mean, it was 415 kilometres altogether from one end to the other, and they built it in 13 months. And the British, when they were contemplating building it before the war, thought it would take at least 3 years, which is why, of course, it cost the lives of 112,000 people, 100,000 of which were locals and 12,000 were the Allies.
Just appalling. The suffering was exactly. I mean, you wonder, people go through those experiences, and as you say, and you must have pondered this: how you get to know the extent of that suffering and what it's done to people.
Well, it's you're an outsider. I mean, all you can do is read their accounts and go to the place and try and get a feel for it. But nobody alive can ever imagine what it's like to be actually in combat, where you're fighting for your life constantly. And then to be a prisoner of war, where you have an equally difficult struggle for survival on a day-to-day basis. And these prisoners of war, you know, they were badly treated when the war ended. They were just told home to go home and forget about the war. They had to battle for every penny they got out of Veterans Affairs, which was called the Repatriation Department in those days. And Fred, for instance, had very good eyesight before the war. He was a crack shot, very good marksman. His eyesight had deteriorated from the lack of vitamins just on the all-rice diet. And he had to battle the government to get them to believe that his eyesight was from the war. And Di said to me how pathetically grateful he was when he eventually received a pair of government-issue glasses, which were round with sort of like pink plastic bits that went over his ears, and how pathetically grateful he was to get them. So, I mean, today the government looks after our veterans very well through DVA, and they're very well cared for. And POWs, well, they're nearly all gone now. But in the last few years of their life, they had a better deal than they got originally. But there were so many of them, and they had to argue and fight for every single concession when we should have been looking after them much better than we did.
Yep. Lynette, you still lead ANZAC Day services on Borneo, don't you?
Yes, yeah. I've just come back.
That's something that you began, actually, and the Australian government now supports as well. What else are you up to?
Oh, well, I take groups along the Death March track. Right. That's in August, and I don't walk anymore. My husband walked about 50 or 60 times over the years, but I don't, and getting a bit weary for that sort of exercise. But I go along as the storyteller and take the groups and help them understand that there's far more to the Death March than just walking along a very difficult path in the heat. You need to actually know the story, and to do that I assign everybody a prisoner of war to follow. Right. So they get quite a detailed profile with a photograph of the usually quite young, quite nice looking young men and their names and everything about them, their families. And when we reach the spot where that prisoner of war died, the person honouring them speaks to the rest of the group about that person. Oh. And that is a lot harder than you might imagine that is to do. And we do have some very emotional moments with people who have no connection to this story, but now they're there walking in the footsteps, and they're walking in memory of this fellow who might have been only 21 years old. The realisation of what war and the implications really hits home, and that is my aim, to actually educate people into the horrors of war, because we really don't want any more wars. I'm very anti-war, even though I write about it. And my aim is to put a human face on the many thousands of people who were caught up in the Second World War, rather than just being a statistic that's quoted, which reduces people just to the level of just a number. I want them to actually have a human side to their story.
Hear, hear to that. The further away we get from it, the more and more people think they romanticise it, don't they?
Oh yes,
but there's nothing romantic about
it. Well, as someone quite famous in the war said, war is a very grim business, and it certainly is a very grim business, and it's something you never ever want to rush into lightly. And hopefully, we will never ever have anything like the Second World War or the First World War again in Australia.
Lynette, always great to talk with you.
Thank you.
And well done on the book. It's called At War with My Father. It's by Lynette Ramsey Silver, and it's based on the memoirs of Fred Howe and Diane Elliott, and you can order it online.
Yes, you can, or through a bookshop.
Exactly. Thanks, Lynette.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.